The socialist argument is that in a different sort of system, workers can in fact elect management, run their own firms, bring new products and services to market without the need for capitalists.
Would Bhaskar really want to live in a society in which birth control is available if and only if a majority of workers votes for it?
Business owners get to impose working conditions that, if given a good alternative, most people would reject.
We don't have freedom lovers under socialism, so please give us a little bit more assurances rather than vague responses. If it's necessary, would you throw people in prison for violating your values?
Okay, well, people are getting situated here. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Soho Forum. It's wonderful to see so many people here. This is a monthly debate series that we actually hold further downtown most of the time, but this was a very popular event, so we have changed locations. My name is Naomi Brockwell, and as a co-founder of the series, I'm absolutely delighted to be here as a guest moderator tonight for this very exciting debate. The resolution is: socialism is more effective than capitalism in bringing freedom to the masses. In favour of this resolution, we have Bhaskar Sunkara, who's the founding editor and publisher of the Jacobin magazine. And arguing against this resolution, we have Jean Epstein, who's the director of the Soho Forum, former economics editor and book review editor of Barron's. So really, really wonderful having you both here. It's going to be very exciting tonight. So up now, while everyone is going through their voting procedure, I want to introduce to you a person that I'm a big, big fan of. He is, of course, part of the Problem podcast. He is a very well-known and very funny comedian, Dave Smith, and he'll be providing our warm-up act this evening. Can you please give him a very warm welcome to the stage?
Hello. Is this on? Oh, okay. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Come on, give yourselves a round of applause for coming out tonight, huh? This is going to be fun. Socialism versus capitalism, the great debate of our time. And I personally am a free market libertarian. I just happen to be a shitty dresser. That's a coincidence, so don't let that throw you off or anything. All right, good. They can take a joke. When we do these things, it's usually very libertarian-leaning, but now we got some free market people here, some socialists, but I think we can all agree that Trump is doing a great job. So there's a lot that we come together on. There's like four people who took that literally, and then the rest of the four MAGA people were right there. But look, we may have some differences, but at least we're here. We're going to settle them peacefully. I think Antifa might come any minute, but I hope for now we can have some fun. I don't know. I heard a socialist told me once that that libertarians, American libertarians, stole the word libertarian from you guys. Is that true? Because in Europe, the word libertarian was more associated with like left wing economics, and then Americans took that. But really, liberals took our word. And then we took your shit because we just didn't have anything. But if it makes you feel better, don't think of it as us stealing your word. Just think of it as us redistributing it to a different class of people who needed it more than you did. Does that make it go down any better? No? Probably not. I don't know. What else can we come together on besides, obviously, our love for Donald Trump? We're all anti-war, probably. Right? Yeah, there we go. Someone's excited about that. That's what I like about the socialists. At least you guys are usually pretty consistent on that one, unless, Obama's doing it. But other than that, you guys are great. Whenever a Republican's going to war, you're usually against that. So that's at least 50% of the time. I appreciate it. Donald Trump, do you guys, do the socialists at least enjoy the kind of burn it down aspect of Donald Trump? Yeah, I thought some of you guys might at least like that, right? No? Oh, when did you guys become such pussies? I thought you were revolutionaries. Don't burn it down. We like our iPhones now. All right, it's fine. Huh? The thing that Donald Trump's grabbed people by. I'm sorry, did I not? I should watch my mouth on these things. I apologize. I knew the left wing was going to be a problem for me on this. Was that a microaggression? I don't know. I don't understand your language. I don't know. Maybe if I was younger, I would understand when to draw the line. I'm out of the game, okay? I'm married. My wife is here, so you can't Me Too me, all right? I'm out of this. My wife is here. She's beautiful, and she's and we're expecting our first baby in 7 weeks. Yeah, that's how you get the left wing off your back. What? Come on. I'm going to be a father. I love my wife. She's incredible. Also, I could not be single in the Me Too moment anymore. I don't know how these young men navigate those waters, but I was like, I got to get out. I don't know, you know, like, how do you even do it? If you're like a 20-year-old single guy, you just like, you go up to a girl and you're like, can I buy you a drink? And she's like, actually, I'm going to call the cops. So that did, and you're like, I don't think she likes me. I don't. Okay, sensitive subject. All right, moving on. I thought the shitty clothes thing, I should have gone back to that. Okay, no problem. So some of you, someone said they did, when I said the Donald Trump burn it down thing, you kind of liked it. Nobody's ever respected the presidency less than now, right? At least that's something. And no one can deal with that guy. I think Bernie Sanders might have done a decent job debating him. You guys Bernie fans? No? All right, they're not very enthusiastic, but they're there. I disagree with most of his policies, but when it comes down to it, I'm a New York Jew. I kind of love that guy. Like, there's something about it. I mean, I know he's in Vermont now, but that guy is a New York Jew to the core. There is, you can't take that out of him. I liked his style. Like, I like how Bernie Sanders debated Hillary Clinton. He debated like he was just going somewhere else. And then they were like, hey, before we go to dinner, you got to stop off and debate Hillary Clinton for a little bit. And he was like, okay, let's do it. You know, like it was, and they were like, you want to maybe run a comb through your hair? And he's like, who has the time? And, you know, like just to go, like, didn't even care. I liked that part. Bernie Sanders, this may not make any sense, but like I feel like Bernie Sanders, like when he's giving a speech, like he's just like the 1% and healthcare and all this. I feel like if you went on stage and just took him and like moved him this way, he would just keep giving the speech this way. Does that make sense at all? Like, I'm not making fun of him for that. It's just like an observation. But I'm a libertarian. I'd say about 90% of us are somewhere on the autism spectrum. So I'm not like trying to. If we cured autism tomorrow, libertarian vanishes. Like, there's no more of us. That's it. We just throw in the towel at that point. I don't know. I'm very excited. I really am very excited to see how this this debate unfolds. It is a super interesting topic. I mean, no matter who wins, I hope you all know that we will still live in a neoliberal warfare state. Like, that's not going away. It doesn't matter how many good points are made up here tonight. We're all still going to be angry. That's another thing libertarians and socialists have in common. We never win. Nothing ever goes our way. Like, Democrats and Republicans, they get to feel good sometimes. We just always have to explain why the person you think we like still sucks. And that's, it's exhausting. I do, look, maybe it's my bias, but I do feel like the socialism is a very... I feel like the hatred of capitalism, I should say, is a little bit of a privileged opinion. I know. Listen, I know. You guys clap because you agree. Whatever. It's fine. So you agree. They don't agree. But I just feel like, look, I'm just giving my thought. I think that when you, like, I know you, a lot of you socialists, you hate capitalism and its excesses, and you go to like Times Square and you're just like, this is disgusting. And I get it. It is. It's like Coca-Cola and McDonald's and these billboards. Everyone's just like consumerism. But I just think only like a privileged person from a rich country would see that. Like, my point is, no one comes over from a third world country to Times Square and they're like, ugh, the consumerism. You know? Like, no one comes from Africa and they're just like, oh my God, the marketing is just everywhere. They come over and they're like, holy shit, food, look at this. Food everywhere. This is amazing. I don't even have to hunt it. I just have to give you some of this paper. Fiat paper, by the way. It's not backed by anything. Hmm? I microaggressed again. I can't help myself, sir. I really would like you. Wow. He just said, great spiel, let's have the debate, ensuring that I can't possibly leave now. I have to stay for a long time. I can't possibly leave on that. I'm not going to let you bully me off stage, sir. Sir, you would lose a fight to my grandpa. You're not going to bully me off of stage. Okay, you disagree with me. I'm sorry if I stereotyped Africa. How about this? For my next comedy set, you can make me a list of all of the offensive subjects I'm not allowed to talk about, and then you can shove it up your ass. Okay, thank you guys very much. Enjoy the debate. I appreciate it.
And on that note, let's invite the speakers onto the stage. I trust that everyone has already put in their votes into the SohoVotes.com website. I am looking at it right now. There are a lot of responses here. So thank you all for that. I'll be closing in just a moment. But let me go ahead and introduce our speakers. So arguing for the resolution is Bhaskar Sunkara, who's the founding editor and publisher of the Jacobin magazine, a leading voice of the American left. He is also the author of the forthcoming Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality, which will be out in April from Basic Books. Arguing against the resolution is Gene Epstein, the director of the Soho Forum. He's the former economics editor and book review editor of Barron's. And once more, the resolution tonight is socialism is more effective than capitalism in bringing freedom to the masses. Can you please give our debaters a very warm welcome to the stage? So I am closing the voting now. For anyone who didn't get your votes in, just realize that in order for your vote to be counted, you have to be voting twice. So, and Gene will be back in 1 second. This is the perfect moment for him to be leaving. Fortunately, he has done this many, many times and understands the format. So I will go ahead and explain the format to all of you. So I'll give you a couple more seconds to vote on there if anyone hasn't already. So we start off with a 15-minute opening remarks from each person, starting with the affirmative from Bhaskar, and then Gene will give his case for the negative. After that, we have 5 minutes of rebuttal from each side, and then I'm going to be inviting the audience to ask questions. So you will notice that we, in this very dark room that you can't see them at the moment, we do have two microphones at the front of the stage. So if you are up the top in the gallery, I saw that a lot of people have since arrived and that's filled up. So I will be letting you guys know if you wanted to ask questions to either of the debaters. I'll be letting you know when you can make your way down and start lining up there. And the same goes for everyone in the audience. If you do want to ask questions to either of the debaters, then I will be letting you know that the microphones again are at the side. Please don't line up before I announce it, because we'll just have a long line of people there. So after that, we'll have 30 minutes of Q&A. I will also at that time invite the debaters to be asking questions to each other. He's back, guys. Yay! This would have been a very one-sided debate without Eugene. So after that, we will have 5 minutes closing remarks from the affirmative, 5 minutes summary from the negative, and then we'll open up the final vote. So now that that is all clear, we are ready to begin. I would like to invite Bhaskar to give your opening establishing case 15-minute remarks.
Well, thank you all for coming. I should say I'm a bit wary of the framing. Actually, I was a bit wary about even coming, but I took inspiration from, I don't know if any of you are basketball fans, I'm very excited that the season is starting. So took inspiration from Jimmy Butler. You know, you might make a scene, but you gotta show up to get paid, so I'm here. So I am wary about the framing statement because it's an assertion that could very well devolve into just terminological debates. I say socialism means one thing, Gene says capitalism means another, I lay out a socialist vision of a just world, Gene says I'm comparing the messiness of an actually functioning system with a theoretical one. So instead, what I would like to do is both lay out the democratic socialist vision and explain how reforms inspired by and enacted by democratic socialists have furthered the cause of human freedom. So, to begin with, I should say that democratic socialism is not an anti-liberalism. We stand in the radical spirit of the Enlightenment, the spirit of those movements that called for liberty, equality, and solidarity. The problem that socialists have with capitalism is that it's both created the material wealth necessary for us to bring about that world, but frustrated its actual realization. So India has a free press. That's a triumph of its social order, but 30% of Indians are illiterate. To fulfill the promise of freedom of press, in actuality, we need to have the right to a universal, high-quality, state-run education. So that's a logic of democratic socialism pushing beyond the logic of liberalism. So similarly, we do have freedom today. We're not living in the worst of all possible worlds, but it's an unnecessarily limited freedom. It's a freedom mostly enjoyed by those who own capitalist private property. The rest of us are at the mercy of those people. By private property, socialists don't mean personal items, but those things that give people who own them power over those who don't. Take a privately owned workplace. Business owners get to impose working conditions that, if given a good alternative, most people would reject. And while workers do most of the work at a job, owners have unilateral say over how profits are divided. So Gene would say that this is merely an employment contract. While socialists say that work or starve is not a fair choice, economic relations aren't free and private. These are contracts that are made under duress. They're contracts that undemocratically give some people tremendous power over others. Now, capitalists and workers, of course, need each other, but it's an asymmetrical dependency. Any employer needs an individual employee less than that employee needs an employer. This realization is at the core of working class politics. The reason why generations of working people have organized collectively to bargain on the shop floor and have also tried to influence politics at a national level through political parties. Now let's look at concrete examples of democratic socialist politics in practice. Examples that I would argue show the enhancement of human freedom in action. So we can see existing societies take Europe's welfare states, in most cases built by social democratic movements, where private property has been undermined through the regulation of capital. In those societies, the majority enjoy a greater range of choice, and they have a greater chance to reach their God-given potential than they do in the United States before. I'm an atheist, I'm not sure why I said God, but roll with it. Those societies limit freedom for people who own private property. If I own a factory and I employ Gene, there's a restriction on my freedom to use the machinery that I purchased with any given set of workers, including Gene, for more than 40 hours a week. That there's a restriction on my ability to unilaterally dismiss Gene. If Gene isn't doing a good job and within the first hour of a screw-up, I want to dismiss him, and so forth. But for the majority of people who don't own private property, for people like Gene, they enjoy a greater range of choice in deciding their life outcomes, deciding the conditions in which they live every day, and a greater chance to reach their full potential. They have this greater freedom not because private property is upheld, but because the freedom for the minority who owns private property is limited. Fundamentally, socialists believe in the rights of people to the fruits of their own labor. Of course, we believe in individual rights and individual freedom, but our individuality can only be developed fully in a society embodying the values of liberty, equality, and solidarity. We don't want an all-powerful government bureaucracy, but we don't want big corporate bureaucracies to control our society either. Social and economic decisions, we argue, should be made by those with whom they most affect. So libertarians can't go far enough to embrace a more expansive vision of freedom. That's because a deeper freedom isn't compatible with a world in which a few own private property and the rest of us are at their mercies to survive. It's not primarily a question of the market, but that of private ownership and the disparities that that entails. Now, what Gene may say, if he was as sharp and witty as me, is that what you're describing is a social system, social democracy, a system where much of social life is taken outside the sphere of the market, where extensive rights are afforded to working people and so on, that might have been enacted even by nominally socialist parties, but that is fundamentally fueled by wealth created through private enterprise. A democratic socialist would have two replies. The first is that the rights I've described above were rights that were foisted upon capitalists and enacted, in most cases, by labor-based parties. Communist regimes ruled on authoritarian coercion, but out of the great workers' movements of the 19th and early 20th century also came profound attempts to humanize capitalism, to make it more democratic. This progress, these efforts, all dependent on wealth generated by capitalism, but capital, everywhere and always, has fought against the implementation of democracy and the expansion of suffrage. And once we got democracy, capitalism has always worked to undermine it, to make sure that the power was never helmed in by democratic processes, by engaged and empowered workers. Why were capitalists so worried about working in democratic societies? It's simple. They thought that if working people had the vote, they wouldn't just stop there. They would extend democracy from merely the political sphere into democratic and social realms as well. That's why all parts of the socialist movement called themselves social democrats for much of its history. Capitalists actually underestimated how resilient their system is. We do live in a democratic capitalist society, a society that's been made more civilized by the efforts of working class movements. But simply, every one of those struggles, every one of those efforts to humanize the system, to bring it closer to our ideals, has been despite the resistance of capitalists. To say that you're a supporter of capitalism today is not to say that you're in favor of markets. I'm in favor of a system of worker-controlled forums operating in a regulated market. To say that you're a capitalist is to say that you're in favor of private property, the rights of individuals to own firms and employ people in wage labor. Democratic socialists don't think of all capitalists, of course, as parasites. It might be in our rhetoric, but in fact, it's not in our analytical vision. Many capitalists do contribute not only their individual talents, but managerial expertise to enterprises. And they often take on tremendous amounts of entrepreneurial risk in starting new ventures. The socialist argument is that in a different sort of system, workers can, in fact, elect management, run their own forums, bring new products and services to market without the need for capitalists. We can do so, of course, in a society where the necessities that one needs to have a good life, access to childcare, healthcare, housing, education, all these things, are guaranteed as social rights and not something prone to accidents of birth or the ability to pay a market price for. But if you're defending capitalism, once again, you're not defending markets. They've existed before capitalism, and they will exist after capitalism. You're defending a form of social organization based on hierarchy and exploitation. Most of our lives are spent in unfree workplaces. A few corporate CEOs make decisions that affect millions of people, and this tyranny bleeds over into other spheres of life. It undermines even political democracy. The noble dream of liberty and justice for all has been frustrated by how wealth and power are distributed, by how undemocratic capitalism is. And if we were to achieve a deeper democracy, an economic democracy, the kind of democracy that allows the majority to live freer, happier lives, then we would see that capitalism is a barrier to that advance. At its core, you know, I'm a Backstreet Boys socialist. You know, I realize what I wrote is very close to Backstreet Boys lyric as I'm reading it. But be a socialist to assert the moral worth of every person, no matter, you know, who they are, where they came from, or what they did. I added the last part. With any luck, future generations will look back at a time when life outcomes or accidents of birth with shock and disgust. The same way we look back on more extreme form of exploitation and oppression, slavery, feudalism, and so on, that have already been done away with. If human beings have the same inherent worth, and it's up to you whether or not that's the case, then they must be free to fulfill their potential, to flourish in all their individuality. In order to realize this expansive freedom, we need to guarantee at least the basics of a good life to all. And given the opportunity to thrive, these people can then contribute to society and create the conditions in which others can do the same. Freedom for working people today, however, means limiting the freedom of those who benefit from the inequalities inherent in class society. Socialism is not so much about trading freedom for equality, but rather posing the question of freedom for whom? And I would argue that socialism is even an extension, in a sense, of freedom for capitalists. Every little fiber of a capitalist being is lost in the effort to remain competitive in the marketplace. Imagine if what Steve Jobs' personality would have been like if he would have been able to flourish in other ways instead of just being, you know, an asshole until his dying day. But it's not Steve Jobs' heart. It's market competition. So now imagine what a change would be like for a young Black American to grow up in a society where they don't have to settle for the worst schools, the worst healthcare, the worst job, or likely to be subjugated to the worst carceral system on earth. Last point is something I know we agree on. Now imagine what it would be like for women if they were more easily able to leave abusive relationships or escape workplace harassment with the help of strong welfare state guarantees. Imagine our future Einsteins and Da Vincis liberated from grinding poverty and misery to pursue their great intellectual and artistic work. Or forget Einstein or Da Vinci. Better yet, imagine ordinary people with ordinary abilities having time after their 28-hour work week to explore whatever interests or hobbies strike their fancies, or simply enjoy the right to be bored. The deluge of bad poetry, strange philosophical blog posts, bad comedy routines will sure be a sign of progress. Every form of exploitation, every form of hierarchy, from feudalism to slavery onward, have once seemed natural and impossible to overcome. One day, I hope people will look back at the needless suffering in this abundant, beautiful planet of ours and recoil in horror. There is a different way. There is a path to freedom. And I think that path involves putting the market, harnessing the market, but putting it behind in the interest of human needs and creating a society in which ordinary people have the freedom to control their workplaces, to own it, to engage with others in such a way that is not possible under capitalism. When libertarians say that they're defending a free system, they're locking in a form of freedom in which we could escape as individuals. An individual worker can become a capitalist, but they're accepting that we cannot collectively all reach this level of creativity and freedom that being a capitalist means in the society. What I'm posing is not the restriction of freedom. What I'm posing is a society in which we could all flourish and reach our potentials. Thank you.
Now Gene will present his 15-minute case for the negative.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to debate this issue with Bhaskar Sunkara. Bhaskar became a socialist at age 14, and for me it happened at age 4. I was a red diaper baby since my mother was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, and I have her FBI file to prove it. You could tell who the FBI agents were in the party because they were the only ones who paid their dues on time. Now, at age 14, I distanced myself from my mother's Soviet loyalties and adopted the vision of the democratic socialists with whom Bhaskar also associates. Socialist values are still a part of me, even though I've abandoned conventional socialism because I've struggled with the issue of freedom. I've recognized not just that capitalism is more effective than socialism in making freedom possible. Under Bhaskar's socialism, the exercise of freedom would be impossible. But here's the good news. Capitalism makes it possible for Bhaskar to achieve socialism without tears, unconventional capitalist socialism that will be far truer to the value of freedom and to the other values that Bhaskar espouses of equality and democracy. And my proposed route to unconventional capitalist-style socialism will be a lot easier to achieve than Bhaskar's chosen route. Bhaskar defines conventional socialism in his essay, "Will Socialists Take My Kenny Loggins Records?" His, quote, socialist vision requires, quote, abolishing private ownership of the things we all need and use, factories, banks, offices, natural resources, utilities, communication and transportation infrastructure, and replacing it with social ownership, unquote. Bhaskar would therefore abolish private ownership of the means of production, which we do all need and use, although you can keep personal property like Kenny Loggins records. Now let's define capitalism. Capitalism is a system in which private property rights in the means of production are both permitted and protected by law. Under Bhaskar's socialism, it would be unlawful for someone to forcibly take your Kenny Loggins records, but it would also be unlawful to own factories, stores, and offices. Under capitalism, it would be unlawful for someone to take your factory, office, or store. But otherwise, the exercise of property rights under capitalism consists of a series of wide open choices about the way people organize their enterprise, how they pay themselves, and the goals they pursue. Bhaskar seems to think that the only conceivable goal under capitalism is the pursuit of profit. But that isn't even true today. Just for starters, of the nearly 30 million small business owners in the U.S., probably about 10 million can hardly be said to be pursuing profit. After they pay themselves as wage earners servicing their own enterprise, there is no profit left over. Their motivation is not profit, but the exercise of their freedom to run a restaurant, bookstore, food truck, grocery store, podcast, blog, or what have you. Or the motive can be the practice of religious freedom, as with the Amish, Mennonites, and Hasidic Jews. Or the motive can be to live in a productive community, as with the kibbutzim in Israel, or the communal movement of the 1970s, spawned by the New Left, of which I was a part. The huge nonprofit sector includes Jacobin Magazine and the Soho Forum. Bhaskar and I commit funds to rent offices and equipment from owners of that property, and we raise revenue from a combination of product sales and voluntary donations from people who gain satisfaction by paying us to provide our products. As I believe Bhaskar recently acknowledged publicly, he is a capitalist, we are both capitalists, and neither of us is motivated by profit. The point, then, is that under capitalism, you can run your enterprise according to any of a whole range of objectives. Each worker can draw the same wage if everybody chooses. All that's required is that you cover your costs, which can be done through many channels. I'll talk about how Bhaskar can capitalize on that in a minute, in a capitalist way. But first, let me explain why freedom would have no chance under his form of socialism. For starters, while Bhaskar won't take our Kenny Loggins records, he will need to shut down the nearly $50 billion in financing raised every year through crowdfunding, which helps launch Kenny Loggins wannabes. He'll also need to outlaw the many other private ways people raise billions in funding to finance their ventures and be prepared to imprison those who defy the socialist law. Instead, economic decision-making would come under democratic control. So let's ask, how many Muslim prayer rugs would the democratic majority of workers vote to produce? What share of construction materials would a majority of workers apportion to new mosques? Right now, under capitalism, vegetarians and vegans, who together make up less than 10% of the population, have more options every year. Would the majority of workers find a need to produce vegan meat or milk substitutes? How important would worker majorities consider hair products for African Americans? Bhaskar has written that he wants socialism to, quote, involve a commitment to a free civil society, especially for oppositional voices, unquote. Admirable statement there, Bhaskar. But now imagine an oppositional voice like mine that wants the democratically elected planners to commit resources to put on public debates catering to libertarians who support capitalism. Or an oppositional voice that needs resources to publicize the idea that the planners themselves are corrupt. Will they really back those who seek to criticize them? Would Bhaskar really want to live in a society in which birth control is available if and only if a majority of workers votes for it? Or would he prefer a society in which private business can produce contraceptives, the preferences of a democratic majority be damned? If contraception at every CVS and Walgreens sounds better to Bhaskar than popular control, he may actually be a laissez-faire capitalist at heart. Or at least he'll see why democratic socialism poses a threat to the freedom he himself treasures. Under capitalism, the mere existence of buyers like Muslims, vegans, Orthodox Jews, and libertarians like me gives rise to suppliers of their needs. The litmus test of people who believe in freedom is that they are willing to tolerate the propagation of ideas and practices they dislike. The intolerant have no problem welcoming ideas and practices they do like. As a believer in freedom, Bhaskar might have noticed the intolerant strain in all societies, including this one. And yet he wants us all to take our chances with the potentially intolerant tyranny of the majority, to which we must all respond, no in thunder. The right to private ownership of the means of production is essential to freedom. But the freedom, of course, can be curbed by repressive institutions, and to a great extent, we're seeing that today. But without the right to private ownership, freedom doesn't stand a chance to begin with. The throttling of freedom under Bhaskar's socialism would probably be worse than I've described. Realistically, that's because most of us will not have enough hours in the day or even any great desire to closely monitor the detailed decisions of the democratically elected planning boards. The planners will have to deal with complex supply chains and must have the power to reallocate workers from co-ops that need to contract to others that need to expand. And here's why the planners will have a perfect excuse for rejecting projects they don't like: the economic reality of scarcity. By scarcity, I mean the fact that what everybody wants always adds up to more than there is. They can therefore reject projects they don't like on the factual grounds that the resources are simply not available. Here's one happy outcome for Bhaskar's socialism. Those oppositional voices will start asking for permission to solicit funds from independent sources, and with those funds, they'll launch their products, choosing to sink or swim in the competitive marketplace on their own. As a lover of freedom, Bhaskar will help lead the capitalist counter-revolution to restore their rights as he starts realizing that freedom and private property rights are inseparable. So crowdfunding will make a huge comeback, and 1,000 other capitalist flowers will be allowed to bloom. I can save Bhaskar the agony of going down this route. He has written, quote, "Workers at all levels know how to make things society needs that can run their workplaces collectively, cutting out the middlemen who own private property," unquote. So Bhaskar, let's talk about how workers, under your leadership, can cut out those middlemen and build socialism in the here and now by owning that private property. You could tap the power of the average consumer. The bottom half of income receivers in the U.S. account for 1/3 of all consumer spending, and the bottom four-fifths for nearly two-thirds. Imagine that Bhaskar could assemble a minority accounting for just one-fifth of consumer spending, dedicated to patronizing firms run according to socialist values. They would have a consumer economy larger than all but a relative handful of countries. Their vision would be to create a huge sub-economy of interconnected firms dedicated to socialist practices. Bhaskar has written that workers would reject employment by capitalists, quote, if given a fair alternative. Well, according to Bhaskar then, firms owned and operated by workers would provide that fair alternative. So other workers would join, dedicating their savings and consumer dollars to the worker-owned firms. Firms could be bootstrapped through crowdfunding. Money could be borrowed through the tax-advantaged medium of employee stock ownership plans. There's also the potential to tap the $3.4 trillion in pension fund money currently held by labor unions in the U.S. and the $41 trillion held by unions worldwide. Here's one activist strategy. The profit margins of existing corporations average 15% of revenue. If the movement commands just 20% of the consumer dollar, it could target companies with boycotts, wipe out their profits, and acquire them on the cheap. Boycotting has an honorable tradition going back to Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, and boycotts are free market acts performed by consenting adults by capitalist means. Instead, Bhaskar wants to play the ugly game of politics by trying to win voting majorities to impose socialism top-down through government edict. My plan can happen much sooner, since a minority will be all that is needed to get the revolution going, and it would be a bottom-up capitalist revolution brought about people who walk the walk rather than just talk the talk. We capitalists could not object, since it would not infringe on anyone's exercise of private property rights in capital goods. As a believer in freedom, Bhaskar has no choice but to follow the route I've outlined to build his socialist vision in the here and now. That was, in fact, the goal of many of us in the New Left in the 1970s, and we failed. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Bhaskar shouldn't try. So, Bhaskar, let's start talking about building socialism through capitalist means, the only means worth employing for freedom's sake. Now, since we know that Bhaskar's socialism, the abolition of private ownership of the means of production, is a non-starter, that it will suppress freedom, since we know that's the route, the only route that Bhaskar wants to go down, this should deal with most of his problems with capitalism. If he doesn't like the fact that capitalists have too many rights, then boycott them, organize. You have the power of the consumer behind you. But if he wants to talk about cherry-picking socialist, quasi-socialist economies in Europe that are fundamentally capitalist, then we can talk about that too. The Nordic countries respect property rights more than the U.S. So if we replicate the Nordic countries, we will, in certain respects, be more capitalist than we are now. But Bhaskar, again, as a lover of freedom, I ask you to march in the direction of those of us in the New Left who tried to do the capitalist experiment through capitalist means. The opportunity is open to you, so please take it. Thank you.
Now we'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal from Bhaskar.
So from the outset, of course, I appreciate Jean's remarks. From the outset, I'm worried that libertarians are losing sight of what they're advocating for, because profit is the aim of all capitalists, and capitalism would not work if profit wasn't the aim of all capitalists. It's not their aim. Dividends isn't the aim of all capitalists. They don't want to necessarily all get personally filthy rich, but once they're engaged in market competition, they need money for expansion, they need money to guard against depreciation, they need money to develop new techniques in order to be competitive in the market against their potential competitors. All capitalists need profits. The search for profits is what actually makes your system works. So I find it quite dubious that basic point is now lost upon libertarians. Now, as it relates to my vision of a just society, I'll break into both the economic sphere and the political sphere. In the political sphere, I imagine that we, of course, need to have a productive role for finance. In other words, there needs to be some sort of way to bring new products and services to market, because I do believe that there will be a role for the market under socialism. I basically believe that there should be a bedrock welfare state, something similar to what you have in Scandinavian social democracies. So that's the state that I mentioned before, where huge swaths of life are decommodified, so basic social rights are granted to people just by virtue of being born. But then there has to be a sphere where there's market competition underway, where worker control firms are competing with each other and producing consumer products. If you want to create a new firm, you'd be able to do so without recourse to private capital, because there could be state-owned banks that are using objective measures based on profitability and other factors, maybe also incorporating certain ecological factors, like cost of externalities, to decide what to fund, what not to fund. But I see it as largely a technocratic and depoliticized process, and the idea is not actually quite foreign to even certain forms of capitalism, in which there are state-run development banks that are not run so differently than private banks, only regulated quite a bit differently. But essentially what that's admitting is that there has to be a price for firm failure. There has to be a price for inefficiency. I guess the difference in this case is that the price for failure isn't going to be utter destitution for the workers who are controlling their own firms. Rather, they'll be able to fall onto the safety net of a welfare state, and the state could then try to encourage people into new sectors that are more dynamic through some form of like active labor market policies. Yeah, it's not a radical experiment. It's social democracy plus worker-controlled spheres. And the decommodification and role for democratic planning that would be there would be only there at the, I would imagine, at the commanding heights of the economy. So other socialists have different views, but this is my view. I'm not asking you to leap blindly into a society you can't imagine. I'm asking you to imagine Scandinavia and imagine then the addition of, instead of private ownership of firms, worker-controlled firms. Now, I keep mentioning Scandinavia because this is a new tactic of libertarians to just say, in fact, this thing that we've been complaining about for 20, 30, 40 years is now all of a sudden extremely extremely capitalist. And I don't have time to get into the debate, but fundamentally, the trajectory of actually building what I describe as democratic socialism has happened through the creation of political parties and trade unions and the seizure of the state. So in Scandinavia, and almost 50 years of uninterrupted rule in Sweden, the Swedish Social Democratic Party decommodified huge swaths of the economy and created a large welfare state. They were still dependent on private industry. They did so largely through sectoral bargaining between workers and capitalists. Now, at a certain point, this system hit its contradictions. There's many reasons why this happened, but one of them is simply that workers were given too many rights. They started demanding things that capital couldn't cede. There was different ways to resolve the crisis. One was the rightward movement of social democracy, reconciling themselves to capitalism. The other way was pushing for a deeper, richer form of socialism, which was actually, ironically, because you mentioned pension funds, it was through a plan to socialize the investment power of capital through pension funds. So we have been pursuing that route. Pension funds and other things are our route from social democracy to democratic socialism, but we were doing so through the state and through the creation of political parties. So we don't need new left communal fantasies or crowdfunding or whatever else. We have a clear, complex, but proven route from the 1930s onward that we've been pursuing as democratic socialists, a route to our vision of socialism.
Five minutes of rebuttal from the negative.
Well, back in the 1970s, Basco, we didn't understand economics that well either. Basco doesn't seem to think Pascal doesn't seem to think that he and I are capitalists. Even though Pascal recently was involved as a capitalist with buying up a firm. Pascal, depreciation is a cost. You don't make a profit by paying for your depreciation. You should learn that. When you and I are renting offices and they depreciate, and the rent that we pay has to pay for depreciation. No capitalist gets profits out of depreciation. That's a cost. We at the SOHO Forum and Bhaskar at Jacobin is bringing in new technology. He's actually planning a movie. He's planning a book. We're planning to expand, and we don't make any profit, but obviously we raise revenue for that. So this idea of Bhaskar's that you need profit, obviously the profit and loss system, I believe, is indeed highly productive, but it's a matter of choice. Under capitalism, it's not something that it has to be imposed on people. If you want to run a company that's profit-making, as most people do, that's fine. But many, many people just run their businesses and earn a salary from it. And, Bhaskar, if they need money to innovate or expand, they raise the money. If they need to pay for depreciation, as every capitalist must, they have to pay for that too. But they don't make any profit out of it. They just raise funds for those things. So please get your economics straight. Capitalism is just a series of choices. Private ownership of the means of production to do what you want with that private ownership. Now, Bhaskar has now used that ugly word, state-owned banks. Bhaskar has told us, we don't need crowdfunding. Okay, you not only don't need it, Bhaskar, I assume it's going to be unlawful. I assume you're going to forcibly shut it down because it's evil, because it raises money for people to own and operate private capital. You want state-owned banks, and you said, hey, look, we have that. Well, you know what that is, Bhaskar? That's the ugly thing we libertarians called crony capitalism, or I prefer to call it crapitalism, after what my Uncle Abe, the socialist, used to call it, state-owned banks, deciding on and evaluating your profit potential. These state-owned banks are going to do that, and we're going to trust them. We can't use crowdfunding. We can't use any alternatives. My SOHO Forum is going to go before these state-owned banks. And they're going to be people with vision, and they're going to be evaluating my potential. It's going to be a totally fair process. And if they turn me down, I'll know that, well, my freedom has been conserved. Well, that is crapitalism. That's the rule by elites. Now, you mentioned the pension fund deal in Sweden. I'm talking about the voluntary movement of peoples into socialism. I am, in a friendly way, trying to call your bluff. What I'm trying to ask you to do is to get consumers. They have enormous power. As I said, the bottom half control 1/3 of all consumer spending. I'm asking you to get them to voluntarily do it and not take away the freedom of people, of Kenny Loggins and Kenny Loggins wannabes who do want to raise money through crowdfunding, of venture capital firms who do want to raise money, of all the dispersed information we have out there that capitalism assembles. No in thunder to your state-owned banks. Bhaskar. Now, apart from that, you mentioned Sweden as though, oh, we libertarians just lately learned that they're capitalists. Well, the Nordic countries have been brought up, and indeed, they're fundamentally capitalist. When the Prime Minister of Denmark said, no, we are not socialists, he knew what he was talking about. But Bhaskar, what you are doing is cherry-picking these countries. You are ignoring Spain, Greece, Italy, Portugal. You're ignoring Venezuela. You're ignoring all range of countries that have chosen this route, and you've decided, the U.S. is going to be like the Nordic countries, like the Swedes. Well, Swedish Americans live better than Swedes in Sweden. And I think that, for example, when it comes to medical care, will we really have Medicare for all, or will we have the Veterans Administration for all? That wonderful government-run medical care system that's turned into a charnel house of bureaucratic killing. That's what can also happen under such regimes. But again, Bhaskar, learn. Capitalism is all about choices. It's not necessarily about profits. Learn your economics and march in the right direction toward voluntarism as a lover of freedom. Thank you.
So in a moment, I am going to open up the floor to audience questions. So if people from the top want to start, make their way down, and you can line up in front of the two microphones there. But before we go into the audience questions and while they're making their way down, I do want to give our debaters the opportunity to ask each other a question, if you have any. So
this on? Yeah.
Yeah. So Gene, if you wanted to go ahead and
Bhaskar,
start.
I have a question. Bhaskar, in a recent tweet you wrote, "Capitalism is bad. I told those workers that I just fired. How's that for freedom?" Now, you have also written that in your system of socialism, there will be worker-owned cooperatives still competing in a regulated market. My question is this. Let's say that there are worker-owned cooperatives having trouble competing in the regulated market and that these co-ops decide to fire workers who are not pulling their weight and to recruit other workers who are more qualified. Their aim would be to make their co-ops better able to compete in the regulated market. Would you allow the firings to happen?
Well, first of all, I never said that, and we actually haven't ever fired a worker. We haven't had to, but we do have procedures to do so through progressive discipline. I imagine it would be the same thing in a worker-controlled firm where workers are shareholders rather than wage laborers. So in other cases, there's a verbal warning, then there's written warnings with points of action, then there's so on, you know, four-step progressive discipline. It's very common. I think that it is a necessary part. In other words, there is both the calculation debate issue that socialism has faced, but there's also incentive issues, and they both need to be addressed. And I think having firm failure and also having some mechanism for internal governance that doesn't involve progressive discipline and firing for inefficiencies would be necessary in any market socialist system while we're still living in conditions of relative scarcity, which we are today.
Would you allow a firm to downsize severely, like cut one-third of its staff if it's having trouble competing?
Yes, of course. I mean, of course. I mean, the firms will need to be competitive in the market. The question is, what happens when you fail? Will it be utter destitution, or will you land into the arms of a welfare state that will be able to take care of your necessities and then get you, if you're willing to go back, into the competitive marketplace? So in other words, we want both voice and exit for workers. We want them to be able to escape the workplace as much as possible.
Do you think that Spain, Portugal,
this is more than one question.
This is a third question here, Jim.
My further question. Do you think Spain...
All right, well, you get three as well, just to be fair.
My final question, Bhaskar, is do you think Spain, Portugal, Italy, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Iceland are fundamentally capitalist countries?
Well, yes, of course. They're all capitalist countries. I would say that there's three different... You consider it in this simple way. There were social democratic movements in Sweden for a time and across Scandinavia. They aspired to a world after capitalism. In fact, what they managed to do is deliver doses of socialism within capitalism. But while delivering these doses of socialism within capitalism, they built towards a sort of crisis. And at this crisis point, the left wing of these movements and these parties pushed for a way to actually resolve these crises by going beyond capitalism, while a right wing saw the easier route and the more viable route as taking a step or two backwards and trying to restore firm profitability and so on. So I think the road to more radical socialism lies through social democracy and isn't counterposed to it. But what I'm interested in is what these parties were, who was their class base, and what they aspired to do, what they managed to accomplish. And there's good and bad lessons. I think some of those countries you mentioned were not, in fact, led by social democratic movements. In some countries, like in Germany, the welfare state was brought about by Christian democracy, looked quite a bit different. in the U.S., our welfare state was brought about through a variety of ways, but largely by a social liberal party. So it's constituted on a different basis than the universal welfare states of Scandinavia. So,
okay. And do you have any questions to ask Gene?
Well, I have a series of assertions, but I cannot on
can
the
you,
fly.
Can you at least pretend well, to phrase them in question
yeah,
form?
No, I will concede.
Pascal, you can make an assertion and say, how about that? That's your question.
Sure.
If he doesn't, I'll add that to the end.
So, I would have one very quick clarification. If you just give me one clarification
Please.
Instead of three questions.
Yeah, sure.
And that's simply that I think when we think about a political sphere under socialism, we again don't have to make this leap into this crazy future no one can imagine. I think it'll consist of a bedrock of individual rights that are guaranteed to all people, freedom of speech and so on. The one right that is very prevalent and is a major feature of this society that I don't think would be given is the right to employ other people in wage labor. So if you want a criticism, it's on that. I think that in the political, so that's a moral and ethical belief. That's the ideological part of being a socialist. I will concede is entirely ideological in that. I think that in a normative sense, hierarchy and exploitation are bad, and to whatever extent it can be mitigated, we should mitigate it. So some forms of hierarchy we'll always need. So if you have a small child, if you're a parent, you wield authority over that child. That's acceptable, an acceptable form of hierarchy in my mind. But it's a hierarchy that's mediated, that's controlled.
It's a very long question,
Bascom. And regulations.
Okay, so how about that, Gene? He has to respond to your assertion.
But then in addition to that, there'll be representative democracy plus certain direct democratic inputs. But that'll be similar to what you have in Sweden or referendums in California or so on. So you'll be free to have the Soho Forum. You'll be free to fundraise for other things as long
from
as...
From whom? From the state-owned banks? From whom? You're shutting down crowdfunding. Do I have to kiss the asses of the state-owned bankers? The capitalist Bhaskar? What do you want?
Well, if you engage in crowdfunding today, you don't have to do it through J.P. Morgan Chase. You could.
What?
You know.
You would allow crowdfunding?
Yes, sure.
As long Bhaskar as Bhaskar would allow crowdfunding.
Create...
A round of applause.
As long as it's
There's
not
50
used to create...
billion dollars in crowdfunding.
As long as it's not used to create an enterprise that employs wage labor.
Oh, of course, wage labor. I see. So, in other words, if somebody voluntarily wants to work for me at the SOA Forum, what happens? And insists on doing... Does that person go to prison?
So,
if he continues to do that, to violate your rule, what happens then, Bhaskar?
If I decide to go to you one day and say, I want to work for the Soho Forum for the rest of my life.
Rest of my life?
And I don't want to get paid, but
what?
I want you to provide food and housing. Would you be allowed to enter an employment relationship like that under this capitalist society? No.
What? Now you just answered your own question? What would you say? Look, capitalist acts between consenting adults, voluntary actions between people. You don't allow those. You are a lover of freedom. You're doing double things. You hate freedom. People should not do voluntary acts. People want to work for me. They want to work for you. Don't you have employees, Beth? Aren't you a capitalist with employees?
No, yeah. I'm actually not even. I'm technically an employee of a board of directors. But, so in other words... What I'm saying is that the employment relationship under capitalism is already regulated. I'm posing a relationship in which this thing, wage labor, is no longer allowed. It's
Don't you realize out. That you've backed away from my question? If somebody voluntarily wants to work for me for what I pay and says I want to do it, you're going to throw that person in prison if that person does it? Against your wishes and values? Is that what you're going to do? How are you going to enforce your rules, Bhaskar? How is that going to happen?
Well, I think that in a society in which most people can do similar labor to what you're describing, but actually be shareholders, actually own shares and receive dividends from a firm, I'm not sure they would choose to do that.
Okay.
Well, I think I directly answer your question.
Well, that's why I'm calling your bluff, Bhaskar. I'm trying to suggest to you that you can work on that and you can achieve it. You can have worker-owned firms under capitalism anytime you want. Just get people to be impressed by your values, Bhaskar. Just talk to them.
So there was...
Put, Just walk the walk and quit talking the talk.
There was mass support for the Meidner pension fund squeeze. There were mass support for the Meidner plan in Sweden. It would have solely socialized production.
Again, Bhaskar, you are a politico. You can't talk the talk of individuals, of individual movements. You want top-down edicts. I'm trying to tell you, quit playing the ugly game of politics, because that can give you Donald Trump. I'm trying to suggest to you, try to impress the grassroots with your values, and then organize them the way King did, the way Mahatma Gandhi did, and then own firms and boycott them and take them over. Work it from the bottom up, Bhaskar, because you're a lover of freedom.
So... You say
so
that
this
the
is
path...
what happens when you don't let him when you don't ask him a question. He gets angry.
But you say that the pathway is through consumer power and boycotts, right?
But where does
your consumer power come from?
Oh, great.
If not the amount of money you have, which is a result of battles at the point of production.
Bhaskar, learn some economics. 1/3 of the consumer dollar comes from the bottom half. Nearly 2/3 comes from the bottom 4/5. Repeat that after me, Bhaskar, because apparently it's something you don't know. Learn some economics. Excuse me?
Okay, we'll get
well,
to the audience
only
in a
United
second.
States.
We'll get to
in the U.S.
Jim, you're just encouraging them. Let's get to the audience in a second. I do want to move
only
on
in
to
the United States, right? I'm talking about the United States.
Jim,
we want the revolution.
Now
here.
We're going to go to audience questions.
Sorry. What? Okay.
All right, so over here, this gentleman in the front, do you want to go ahead and ask your first question? You can address either of the debaters. Can we turn that microphone on if it's not already? Bring it up a little bit. By the way, I really appreciate the passion up here. Is this not entertaining? Do we not entertain you?
I thought I was the one who was going to have a Jimmy Butler moment.
I mean, this is just the start of the Q&A. I'm very excited to see what happens. All right, go ahead, Mark.
Mark Skousen. I'd like to get your take on both of you on John Mackey's book, Conscious Capitalism, where he develops the stakeholder philosophy of working together. And this is Whole Foods, the CEO of Whole Foods. Where they have teams that make decisions on salaries, so these are employees. So you have a form of social democracy or democratic capitalism already in the conscious capitalism model, stakeholder philosophy. I'd like to get your take on that new approach to capitalism.
This is a question for both the debaters.
Yes.
Bhaskar? Multiple questions the socialist way, Bhaskar. One question at a time.
So I would say there's different ways to organize capital's workplaces. Some could be extremely hierarchical, some could be more horizontal. My objection to the capitalist workplace is the fact that it's privately owned by individuals, and it inherently relies on a form of exploitation. I don't mean to describe a literal labor theory of value in my quick thing that I'm saying, but rather that it's a good framework to understand how this works. Simply, if Gene is employed by me, I'm not sure I would based on his temperament, but he might
That's
be a
fair.
True great union organizer. He might be a rabble rouser, but and he's stably employed for 10 years by me. And I'm paying him $15 an hour over the course of this 10 years, then you could probably assume one thing based on that relationship, that Gene's probably worth more to me than, you know, than the $15 an hour I'm paying him. And we're going to have certain battles over how much money is going to be paid. And this is the root of a lot of the pressures that exist at every workplace. You know, people want to get paid more. They know there's certain limits on what they could get paid. In other words, Gene can't demand $100 an hour because if my firm is no longer profitable, then none of us are employed. But there's, you know, there's this tension that exists in all workplaces. It certainly exists at Whole Foods, where there has been worker actions, where people are demanding kind of different things. But the main thing they're demanding is higher wages and more autonomy. And no capitalist, no matter how conscious they are, is going to give that to them. It's going to be the result of a political battle on the shop floor. It's not going to be, you know, decided by a theory or ideology of this version of capitalism or that version of capitalism.
Well, in answer to the question, certainly John Mackey's idea of conscious capitalism is better than a lot of other ideas. It seems to work well at Whole Foods, and I support it. I don't know if it's valid for all firms. I can want to observe that Bhaskar is at least granted that if he was a capitalist and I was a worker, he'd be afraid of me, even though I would just be a worker. So clearly, there might be other kinds of relationships that workers and employees can have. And again, Bhaskar keeps ducking the two questions, which is, why doesn't he create worker-owned firms if he doesn't like firms owned by a handful of people? That's quite possible under this capitalism. And would he actually throw in prison people who violate his values, who choose to work for capitalist firms voluntarily, even though, as I've said, his quasi-socialist alternative would be available? He ducks that question as well. Someday, hopefully tomorrow, he'll face those two questions and see the light. Thank you.
So we'll go to next question over here. And just a reminder, if you're asking a question from the floor, don't give us statements. Make sure that you're asking questions and keep it short.
So my name is Jenny Brown. So I wonder if both the speakers could address the situations that we see on the shop floor in, for example, production companies in the U.S., where it's no degrees of freedom. You have, you're given 3 minutes to urinate once a day. Sometimes you have to wear diapers on the line because you will be fired if you go. There are no choices about whether you can have work overtime. You have to, or you will lose your job. So just the situation that is existing right now under capitalism with private ownership, if you could just address the working conditions that is kicking up.
And what percentage of workers do you think work under those circumstances?
It's about 20%.
20%. And you said, and that's in factories.
Who are not allowed to urinate. Yes.
Do you know we don't even have 20% of the workers in factories to begin with, but 20%?
No, not just factories. Some school teachers have to bring their whole class into the bathroom so that they can pee.
Oh, right. Okay, then, all right, okay, that's good. All right. Good to know. I had to run out to pee myself recently, as you noticed. So I empathize with that. Oh, sorry for the stupid joke. Anyway, so Bhaskar, do you want to answer that or should I?
You can go ahead. Oh, okay, yeah. You're doing such a great job so far. I'm going to let you keep going.
Well, we have an educational system that pays that pays nationwide $10,000 a student. In New York, it's $20,000 a student. And that means that for every 30 kids in a class in New York, there's $600,000 that could be realized. How much of it ends up in the classroom? Nationwide, there's $300,000 that could be realized. The schools are run by government bureaucracies. So that may explain why, despite the fact that there is that spending on schooling in this country is at a record high in inflation-adjusted terms, that may explain why the problem that you've suggested, that you've talked about, exists. That we may want to free it up from government control. And that's the reason why poor people are oversubscribing the charter schools and the voucher schools, because they spend their money so that kids do not have to pee in the hall. That's the capitalist alternative, which, by the way, 15% of Swedish parents send their kids to voucher schools. And now, the other part of it is that you should join with me, as should Bhaskar, in trying to combat the capitalism in the labor markets, to free the labor markets so that laborers have alternatives. Government control on the behalf of special interests of so many professions is locked up. To be a beautician, to be a florist, to be a plumber. Do you know how difficult it is to become a plumber in New York because of the state-supported plumbers union? All of those alternatives should open up for laborers, but they are closed because, unfortunately, people like Bhaskar think that government control, all this credentialism and all these barriers that make it difficult for laborers to shop around, to get better jobs, to work under better working conditions, are closed off to them. That's the evils of capitalism that we libertarians are trying to fight and that you should fight also. But with respect to the schools, what you should really fight, really do, is liberate all of that money so that the $300,000 average can get into that classroom and the kids could be peeing on gold-plated urinals with that amount of money.
So the actual question was about the conditions of huge segments of American workers, and I don't know the exact figure, but it is a large segment of American workers in increasingly precarious jobs, working in factories with very limited rights. And the simple reason why it's like that is because American unions are weaker than its counterparts anywhere else in the advanced capitalist world. Therefore, American workers have the same rights and are afforded the same dignity as workers with very weak bargaining power in the third world, often. And that's a real reason. And if you want to give people more rights, if you want to build union rights to say that, okay, everybody deserves a 5-minute break every hour, you know, or whatever else, the very bare bones basics, then you have to, at the very least, fight for the right to collectively bargain. You have to fight for the sort of legislation that libertarians, that big capitalists, that small capitalists all have historically opposed. And my only aside is on Gene's two questions. I'll answer very quickly in a yes or no way. One is worker-owned firms under capitalism are fine, but they're subjected to a lot of the same pressures, competitive pressures as other firms. So we want to build a society in which you have the bedrock decommodifications that I talked about, where we have Medicare for all, where we have certain basic education rights, and so on. So that's most of our reform efforts are focused there.
Since this idea is new to you, Bhaskar, then let me try to make the same point. The bottom half has control of one-third of the total consumer dollar. Consumer spending could be dedicated to those socialist firms and support them in whatever way you want. Nearly two-thirds is controlled by the bottom four-fifths. Please learn some economics about the power of the consumer that you can marshal. That could be a sub-economy of socialist firms, and you could subject them to whatever try to learn that.
There already
it's new to you.
Economy of cooperatives that are thriving in places like Spain. Mondragon is a large cooperative. It at one time was the sixth largest business in Spain, but these are subject to a lot of the same competitive pressures. So I think, in other words, there's a difference between a cooperative under capitalism and a worker-controlled firm under a post-capitalist society, where capital no longer holds the power to withhold investment, where there's not a separate class of people continually trying to undermine reforms.
Again, you're beating a hasty retreat. You're beating a hasty retreat to some example.
I'm not hasty at all. I'm taking my time.
What I'm trying to do is trying to suggest to you the potential in the American economy for what you can do. We in the New Left in the 1970s, we didn't look at what others had done badly. We try to look at the potential of what we can do. Look it in the face, and you'll see that
answer your second question.
Please do.
Gene, you're from the New Left. Did you smoke weed in the 60s?
Are you wondering whether that explains something?
Well, I'm just saying that maybe it's time to get back on it, you know? On the second question, no, I don't think coercion would be necessary.
Well, but you know,
but it's a political system.
I like that.
It's a political system. Laws are decided.
What if it is necessary, Bhaskar? Would you apply it? What if people voluntarily decide to work in conditions that you don't like, and they say, "No, I want to do it," and then you say, "Well, you have to stop doing it." "No, I can't stop doing it." What would you do then, Bhaskar? Look, the problem you are facing is that we have the awful experience of socialist societies, most recently the experiment of socialism in Venezuela, most recently what happened in China, millions dead. We don't have freedom lovers under socialism, so please give us a little bit more assurances rather than vague responses. If it's necessary, would you throw people in prison for violating your values?
The values, it's not, we're not writing a blueprint for the future.
That's
great. If I'm in charge of a socialist society, then of course not, you know,
exactly. That's what I said. Exactly.
There'll be a judicial system that'll have certain criteria for when it throws people in prison. It'll have certain criteria for what speech is allowed and what's not. And it will probably draw on existing types of jurisprudence. So for example, clear and present danger. You know, it's not a leap into an unknown future. It's not a year zero break with the past. We're saying that there are certain spheres of life that are right now only available to people who could pay, but should be available to everyone as part of their basic needs. We're saying that there are certain forms of exploitation and oppression that exist in the world today that we think we construct a society where it doesn't exist. Full stop.
I think you said you would not shut down crowdfunding. And that's good to hear. And I think, actually, if you ran the Society of Bhaskar, you'd very quickly lead the capitalist counter-revolution because you would get sick and tired of those state-owned banks that are not granting people opportunities. That's what you would do. My fear, however, Bhaskar, is that maybe somebody like you will not be in charge. Maybe the worst will get on top. Maybe power-hungry people will. But if you were in charge, socialism wouldn't last a month. Because you would find how hateful it is, because you're a lover of freedom.
And we'll go to the next audience question over here.
This one's for Bhaskar, although maybe both chime in if there's time.
Yeah, I probably will.
It would be hard to stop him.
To that point, in solidarity with Bhaskar, I would support state-subsidized acupuncture session for Eugene immediately following this event. Sorry.
Anyway. I didn't catch that, but it sounded funny.
It was a half-baked joke.
Yeah.
In 2017, the average top 20 CEO comp was $66 million versus the comparable average comp for the top 20 athletes of $62 million. It's a difference of about 6%. Those numbers include options and bonus for CEOs and include sponsorship pay for athletes. Which group do you think creates more positive value and prosperity for society? And do you think athlete compensation and, by extension, celebrity compensation, which is very similar to those levels, deserve as much public scrutiny as CEO pay?
I would say no. I don't even support a salary cap in sports. These are athletes that are creating value, and they should be remunerated for the value they're creating. They're creating the value through their own efforts and their own individual talents. And they're not creating value through the labor of others. So I think LeBron James should be making many times more than what he's earning now. At the very least, but obviously, you know, he's collectively working on a team. And the point of any good collective bargaining agreement is sometimes to boost the conditions of the worst paid or worst conditioned players. So in this case, NBA players in the G League. And sometimes that means kind of caps on the best paid, but that's a collective democratic decision that actually LeBron James was the major figure in the players' union.
Should point out the NBA players agreed to the salary cap that they currently work under, right? It was collectively bargained. So it's not random. I mean, the premise of your response is sort of that it's random. It's not random.
Yeah. So the cap itself...
Well, we don't need to get sucked into the NBA.
Yeah, of course. But I think the bottom line is that I'm not worried about the amount of money or the amount of wealth that anyone wants, that anyone gets as a result of their exceptional talents or ability. Obviously, this is a small percentage of society. And also that I think my conception of class is not... it's more relational than gradational. So, in other words, you could be a capitalist and run a small firm of four or five people and be struggling and earn $30,000 a year, or you could be a worker in a privileged sector or a very capital-intensive sector like a longshoreman and earn $90,000 a year. And I would consider one a worker and one, some sort of small capitalist.
Yeah, those just two quick observations. Those $30,000 capitalists who are indeed legion were the people I spoke about. They are not in it for profit. They're just simply drawing a wage out of their business that pays them for the services to their business. That's another good example of why not even today is private ownership of the means of production always pursued for profit. Again, Basco and I are capitalists. The only thing I would say to your question about athletes are that, again, the capitalist system, the ways in which labor mobility is limited, which indeed it's also limited by unions, the capitalist system whereby profits are privatized and losses are socialized. The best example of that was Obama's bailout of General Motors and Chrysler, again, socializing losses, which shafted auto workers in the South and favored unions in Michigan because he was courting the Michigan vote. That's capitalism. And in the sports case, the capitalism of government subsidizing sports stadiums for these very rich firms is obviously an outrage that Bhaskar should also oppose. Up until the 1950s, the teams paid for their own stadiums.
I'm a big James Dolan fan, so I won't oppose it. I think he's a great leader,
so
great American.
Screw him. People who don't go to the games have got to contribute.
Great blues player, too.
Even people of limited means have to. It's okay with you. All right.
Next question from the audience.
Thank you. My name is Harry.
My friend.
Yes. I want to first make an assertion, and that assertion is that...
Can you phrase your assertion in the form of a question?
Well, yes, it's going to be in a question. Yes, it is. I have to start over now. I was interrupted. Okay, so... the assertion is that it is competitive capitalism that is creating something, an externality called global warming. And global warming is threatening our very survival on this planet. Capitalism is responsible for this. It is competition. Competition where all of us are... competition creates winners and losers. And in this case, this externality is going to be such a losing proposition for all of us that the human race is going to be out of here in a few more generations.
So what is your question, sorry?
Well,
so,
I got your question.
Question is, how do you address the issue of competition creating such negative situations? It automatically, structurally creates winners and losers. Competition does. It creates winners and losers.
Lisa, Basco, did you want to go first?
The question about global warming, is that it? Yeah.
How does it create, it creates bad externalities. What is your response to this?
One particular bad externality is that competition creates...
Right, Basco, you had something to respond.
It creates losers.
To play devil's advocate in the scenario you just
Basco's
laid out.
Basco's coming over to my side. That's good. Yeah.
In the scenario you played out, you could find ways to price in, some of these effects through carbon taxing or whatnot. But I think as a whole, the reason why capitalism creates these sort of problems is less the market competition end of it, but the fact that the grow or die imperative of capitalist firms isn't restrained. I also would argue that under socialism, as I envision it, where the sector for consumer goods is by worker-owned firms, the same imperative doesn't actually apply, right? Because you're not trying to maximize total revenue. So you're not building these mega firms. What you're trying to do is maximize revenue per shareholder, revenue per worker. So you might want a firm of 40, 50 people, which would solve part of that. But I think in general, a society in which there is a more robust, responsive state, where there is a greater role for elements of planning and organizing certain aspects of the economic plan of society, which, by the way, sounds very pernicious and scary for those of you in the room that are libertarians, but most societies have actually had industrial industrial plans at one point or another. Developing states have all done it, all within a capitalist framework. I think that kind of society with more room for democracy and empowerment of ordinary people is obviously going to be able to think about the medium and long-term effects of growth and development.
Well, I think Bhaskar at least did say that obviously you can have carbon taxes, you can rein it in. Clearly, it's not capitalism that causes global warming; it's industrialism. And the Soviet Union was not capitalist; it was massively polluting. China,
excuse me, competing
with the United States. Okay, so that's why they did it. Okay, all right. Well. Well, I think as Bhaskar would agree, and I'd have to disagree with you. I'd have to say that industrialism, which involves the use of fossil fuels, it involves the heavy machinery, it involves all kinds of things that produce output. And under Bhaskar socialism, they might not want to maximize revenue. As I just said, under capitalism, you don't have to maximize for profit. But if you're going to put out stuff that's based on a fossil fuel economy, you're going to pollute. And of course, there are ways of dealing with it. Do you want to? Are you saying that the use of fossil fuels only happens under capitalism, sir?
No.
No. Oh, good. Okay. Then no. That's good. Then you answered my question. Then the use of fossil fuels is what's polluting, causing global warming.
And why don't we get onto solar, wind, and geothermal energy? Why don't we do it? Because the coal, oil, and gas industry is stopping it from happening, which is.
Do you agree with that, Bhaskar?
Who owns our government?
Do you agree with that, Bhaskar?
And the market system will never get us out of this.
All right. Well,
no. I think it is true that. You know, under a system like capitalism, economic power does translate into political power, and there are certain lobbies preventing the emergence of new technology. But more important is the fact that green renewable technology, there is a cost curve involved, and I think that a more proactive government-pushed industrial policy could bring about an energy transition quicker. I mean, this is not a radical.
That's why we needed Obama to subsidize Solyndra, because we needed more capitalism. And again, Bhaskar talks about those wonderful state-owned banks. That really scares me. When he uses the word state, usually I didn't want to use that word for Bhaskar because usually they like to say no, not the state. It's going to be Democratic councils. State-owned banks are capitalist, and it really depresses me that Bhaskar deludes himself into thinking that those state-owned banks will be the only place we can go to raise money for the SOHO Forum.
North Dakota loves their state-owned banks.
Well, I think it is funny that Gene can summon the depths of the gulag, the timer rooms, killing fields, but instead he's focusing on the North Dakota, State Development Bank.
I am. That the gentleman is.
Yeah, but you're saying state-owned banks are this great pernicious evil, but you're not even, I haven't even heard the word gulag from you yet.
I'm saying that if you want to abolish everything other than state-owned banks, then you are going to suppress freedom. And the state-owned banks are not the gulag, they're not the pernicious freedom, but they're just a bunch of people who are giving other people's money away. They're not putting money at risk. They are capitalists. They are not capitalists. They are obviously not what we want. We want crowdfunding. You're not going to abolish crowdfunding, I thought you said. $50 billion a year of it. You're not going to abolish it?
I think if you were going to make, if I was Gene, I was going to make a case against democratic socialism to young Americans that are prone to democratic socialism. I would say this. If you pursue my route as a hyper-capitalist, you're going to find 5% growth rates over the next century. And yeah, we'll figure out a way to innovate our way out of climate change.
You ducked my question.
If you pursue his route, you're going to get 3.5% growth.
Wow.
And that 1.5% difference is a matter of life or death for hundreds of millions of people all around the world. I mean, but instead we're getting this whole inventing of language or whatnot. He's not even defending what he's here to defend, which is capitalism. You should take a picture lap.
Private ownership of the means
of production. In a capitalist society.
What? I'm sorry?
Your side has built a society. Obviously, we've tried to humanize it and change it over time, but you're living in a capitalist society.
Can't be done.
This is
sir.
This is
please.
This is a thing that libertarians.
Sir, we love you, but why don't you just come on stage and take over?
No, no, Gene, don't put that offer out there. All right, we've unfortunately run out of time. We've run out of time here for Q&A, but thank you so much for the questions. Just a reminder, obviously we've got closing statements now, but this is a very heavy issue that we're not going to solve in a two-hour debate. So there is wine and cheese and everything afterwards where you can continue to ask questions. Both of them will be around, but we have not finished. We have not finished.
I will not be.
We now have our 5 minutes closing statements from the affirmative. Bhaskar Sankara, if you wanted to go ahead and close up your side.
Thank you all for sticking around. Thank you for moderating this. It's an unenviable task, and I really do appreciate it. Thank you to Gene for the invitation. Actually, he was very persistent in getting me here. He did everything organizing it. You know, he even gave me the pen that I'm using in the debate, so he was very cordial setting it up and whatever else. So I really do appreciate it, and I appreciate the audience. Yes. He literally ripped his notebook in half to give me something to press on, to write on. So, you know, I do appreciate it. Now, capitalism, of course, has proved remarkably durable, far beyond the expectations of socialists, 100-plus years ago. But from a different perspective, the history of working-class politics since the days of Marx and Engels has, in fact, been a great success. You know, God, I'm once again mentioning God, rested on the seventh day. The labor movement gave us the sixth off. We went from an era when capital ruled unchallenged to one with powerful limits on its conduct. The 40-hour week, labor and environmental regulations, and more. These reforms and the broader progress of women's liberation and towards racial equality are constantly under siege, but they happen. We don't, as I said before, live in the worst of all possible worlds. The world we live in, as brutal and unequal as it is, has been made more humane by class-conscious movements, by the efforts of democratic socialists. This consolation seems like a small one, given how lofty our ambitions still are. But many, not Gene obviously, would agree that, you know, socialists have always understood how capitalism works. They even proved capable of reforming some of its ugliest features. But why would we want to repeat the disasters of the 20th century, but once again, struggling to go beyond it and create a socialist system. I've tried to offer, in a series of scattered and increasingly erratic interventions, a few answers to that question. Now, the first is that the tremendous suffering in the world today demands a response. Capitalist development has created mass abundance, but it hasn't met the needs of the most vulnerable. Millions still die every year of preventable diseases. Many more spend their lives mired in poverty. The second answer is, as I mentioned, ideological, and I'll admit that. Capitalism is based off wage labor, which rests on the exploitation and domination of humans by other humans. Democratic workplaces embedded in an economy committed to the moral worth and flourishing of all could make this subordination no longer necessary. A third answer, even if we're content to simply reform capitalism, these reforms will be continually undermined by capital's structural power. Addressing that dilemma will mean pressing on to democratic socialism. A good social democracy can get us pretty far along the road to justice, and we know that social democracy works. And presumably where it falls short, it can be improved without completely doing away with private ownership. But there's more than an ideological motivation for a radical socialism. Well, I consider myself a democratic socialist, not a social democrat. More than the moral idea that the exploitation of people by people is a problem in desperate need of a solution. Capitalism both creates the precondition for radical human flourishing and prevents its ultimate fulfillment. For socialists, to the extent that some hierarchies linger, they have to be constantly justified and held in check. Today, I think we would all agree that extreme forms of slavery, of exploitation like slavery, should be prohibited. The socialist argues that wage labor is an unacceptable form of exploitation and that we actually have alternatives now to empower ordinary people to control their destinies
inside and outside their workplace. But even I have a hard time imagining that the abstractions of ideology will be enough to encourage a risky leap from a humane social democratic world, the world that we could build, into an unknown socialist one. If that happens, I imagine it'll be driven through practical necessity, through the day-to-day struggle to preserve and expand reforms. Socialists have survived a lot over the past century. It survived persecution from tyrants and the tyrants that it itself gave birth to. It survived the radical reshaping of capitalism and that of its great protagonist, the working class. But does socialism have a future? Will democratic socialism actually propel people to a more free and prosperous system? I have the utmost confidence that a world in which some thrive by depriving others of freedom, billions needlessly suffer amid plenty, and we move closer to ecological catastrophe is unacceptable. I also believe that as long as we live in a society divided by class, there will be a natural opposition to inequality and exploitation. There will be technical and political barriers to progress that we can't underestimate, but if we're to make something of our shared homeland, socialist politics, broadly conceived, offers us the best tools for getting there and to thinking about what's wrong with capitalism today.
And now our 5-minute summary from the negative.
Well, when Bhaskar ducked some of my questions this evening, there was at least one case in which I was heartened that he did duck the question. Because when I kept asking him in his socialist society, would he shut down crowdfunding and make it unlawful? And if something's unlawful, you get punished. He couldn't answer the question. He fell back on statements, all jurisprudence. But he wants a social society in which private ownership of the means of production is not permitted. So again, if it's not permitted, it's unlawful. If it's not unlawful, you use the power of the state to punish people who break that law. Even let slip, well, yeah, maybe I would allow crowdfunding. That was a good sign. Then when I asked Bhaskar, would you make it unlawful for somebody to work for me or work for him just on whatever terms they choose? And if you don't want them to do that, well, it may not be necessary, he said, to prevent them. Well, yes, but if it were necessary, what would you do? When I asked him, why would you want the state-owned banks to be the only forum? Well, maybe they're not so terrible. Well, you know, again, we know, I know at least, that Bhaskar, once he confronts the implications of what he's really talking about, is going to back away from what he's really proposing, the outlawing of these practices because he doesn't approve of them. Well, where he ducked my question continually and where he kept insisting that somehow or other this is not doable, he ducked my question by not realizing that we in the 1970s realized that the record of real socialism with a real abolition of private ownership of a means of production has been so horrific that it's unimaginable. The millions who died in China, the repression in China, the fact that the quasi-socialist Hugo Chavez most recently kept being cited for human rights abuses. I didn't want to stick him with the appalling record of socialism, but what I really want him to confront is this. He cannot keep talking about how, well, we're going to evolve, we're going to experiment, we're going to see, we don't know, we'll develop. Well, unfortunately, after a century of horrors from the record of socialism, we need better answers than that. And then most importantly, where Bhaskar backed away was when I kept telling him that you can have the socialist revolution tomorrow. You can start it going. You don't need forcible government edict, top-down edict to bring about. Even at best, that will not be a socialism worth having. You should understand private ownership of means of production offers you all the opportunities you want to create consumer economies that will only buy from your worker-owned companies so they can run things the way they want because the consumers who buy from them want to buy from them. You can take over companies. All of that potential Bhaskar kept backing away from. And I only ask him, as a lover of freedom, try to confront that. Try to understand what socialism through capitalist means can offer him, just as we in the New Left understood as well. It's a very difficult experiment. Face it. Please call your own bluff. Bring about the socialist economy. Quit pretending that consumers, that the average person has no power. When the bottom half have one third of the consumer dollar and the bottom four fifths have nearly two thirds. Quit pretending that there's no power when $3.2 trillion is controlled by pension funds that could voluntarily, not through forcible edicts. Quit pretending that the state-owned banks said, well, it's been done and, you know, it works fine and the North Dakotans love it. Quit pretending that that should be the only stop in a free society. To those who would tell us that, we have to abide by the decisions of the majority or by the state-owned banks. We freedom lovers, including Bhaskar, will have to say that. No, we understand that you cannot have freedom without the option of private ownership. But the good news is that it not only lifts the living standards of the broad masses of people, it offers the freedom to practice socialism by capitalist means. Bhaskar, I invite you to learn that and put your mind around it. Thank you.
Once again, the resolution, socialism is more effective than capitalism in bringing freedom to the masses. So our results here. The yes vote, beforehand it was 26%, and afterwards it was 30%. We had a change of 3.7%. That is the score to beat here. The no vote started out at 52%, and then it changed to 63%, so the change was 11%. And that means that the winner here is the no vote. They picked up more points there, so the Tootsie Roll goes to Eugene. So well done. The prestigious Tootsie Roll Prize, everyone.